Sit, Christmas. Sit. Sit down.
And you have to put your mouth right up to them like you're eating them.
Oh.
Let me adjust it for you. There, so your lips are almost touching them. Let's make
like this.
Go in between them. There's two of them.
Like
that. Exactly.
There you
okay.
go.
Well, I'm here to welcome Mr. Michael Hinkson to the Erlbaum Center on behalf of the book club of the Erlbaum Center. And Mr. Hinkson needs to know that his book has the distinction of being the only book that we have read twice in our book club. We read it in 2013 and again in 2017. And it's exciting, it's fun, it's exhilarating, it's inspiring, and it was a wonderful read. And you don't want to listen to me, you want to listen to him. So I'm going to ask you now to please welcome Mr. Michael Hinkson.
That. You said that before. Well, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Sit. Adjust the mic up.
I'm going to.
Stands a little tight.
I know, but it's okay.
Got it? Yep.
Well, there we go. Now we've adjusted the mic a little bit. Can all of you hear me outside?
Yep.
No, you're inside. You don't have to say that. So without the inside people saying anything, all of you who can hear me outside, raise your hands. Okay. It is really an honor to be here at Erlbaum. I had a chance to talk to the staff earlier, and now I really get to do the fun part, which is to talk to all of you. And as Jean said, I am the author of Thunder Dog. I and a colleague, Susie Flory, wrote the book actually together. Thunder Dog is in part my story as a blind person growing up and learning skills, and it's also the story of what happened to us at the World Center on September 11th, 2001. The stories are really interrelated because I believe that without learning the life lessons and the life skills that I was taught by my parents and learned through my whole life, I would never have survived on September 11th. And I want to talk about some of those lessons as we go through the day, because I think it's relevant to all of you. Let me start by telling you one of the most important things I think that all of you should know, especially because a lot of you have lost your eyesight more recently, were able to see for a while, and now you've lost your eyesight. How many of you here have been blind your whole life? Anyone?
I have.
You have. Okay, we have one person. Anybody outside? If you yell, we'll hear you. All right. So all of you have lost your eyesight later in life.
Yeah.
Here's what I want you to know. That doesn't mean a thing. Now, I know that a lot of you will disagree, but the problem is that most of you who have lost your eyesight grew up in an environment where you were taught that eyesight is the only game in town, and that in fact being blind is being inferior. That is simply not true and doesn't need to be true for anyone in this room, no matter what society has taught you. I want to tell you the story that I told the staff earlier about a friend of mine named Don. Don was sighted in the 1960s and worked for Iowa Bell, which was the part of the phone company, because at that time it was all the big Bell company and all the little baby Bells, sub-companies that were all part of the big company. Don sold business equipment to corporations and companies around Iowa. He was the number one salesperson in Iowa, bar none. He sold more than twice his nearest colleague in Iowa Bell. He was very successful at his job. He also was a type 1 diabetic. And over a very short time, he lost his eyesight when he was close to 30 years old. So Don had been sighted for a good part of his life. He happened to be in a state that in the 1960s and 1970s had the best agency for the blind in the country, also bar none. It was a residential program run by a man, and the agency taught people that blindness wasn't the problem. It was our attitudes and our fears and our misconceptions about blindness that were the real problem. Specifically, what Don did was to go to that agency, which was a 9-month immersion course run by the state to teach Don and others what it was like to be blind. They went to the agency and they were taught skills such as Braille. Everyone in the agency who went to take the course took a woodshop course, took a cooking course, took a home economics course. They took orientation and travel, taught by blind people, by the way. They learned all the skills that a body would need to know if they were going to function as an individual in the world, except they learned the blind people, so they learned blindness skills. One of the things that they had to do before they could graduate from the course was to walk a 5.3-mile route that they spent several months learning parts of until they had the whole course assembled. And you know what? Along the way, they were not always supervised by other people. You never knew when you were going to be monitored and when you weren't. Don also, as part of the course, was there during the summer when the students at the Iowa Commission went out and chopped down trees and cut them into logs to be used in the fireplaces around the Iowa Commission. They did a lot of stuff and learned that it was okay to be blind. After Don graduated from this 9-month experience, he went back to doing exactly what he did before he became blind. He was a sales guy at the Iowa Bell Company. And you know what? He continued to be number one. He continued to be number one in sales, selling more than twice what his competition was selling. He did that very successfully for quite a period of time. And then a job opening came along at the at the phone company to teach people to do what he was doing. He applied for that job because it would have been, by any definition, a promotion. He was denied the job. He was told, we really like you where you are. You really should just continue to do what you're doing, and so on. And Don said, well, wait a minute. I'm doing this job. Why not teach it? Well, we just really like you where you are. He called in the Iowa Commission as his advocate. They eventually found out that what the telephone company had decided was because Don was blind, he couldn't teach the course. He could sell. He could be more successful than anyone else, but he was told that he could not teach the course. Don decided that if they weren't welcoming him as an equal in the company and giving him the opportunity to take that new job, he was going to quit. He did so, and he took his customers list with him, and he started his own company. He started his own company to do exactly what he was doing before he left Iowa Bell. The only difference was that Don said to all of his customers, I'm going to charge you half of what I would save you over a 3-year period. So if I could demonstrate to you that the phone company's price was $500,000 for your equipment and my price would be $300,000, I'm going to charge you half of the $200,000 I would save you over a 3-year period. So he did. I asked him once if he ever had a situation where he didn't charge anyone anything because he didn't save them anything. And he said, well, I had one customer who I saved 5 cents over 3 years, and he paid me a nickel. Don did that job for many years, and when he returned from doing that job, he told me he paid more in taxes his last year than he received as a salary and commission from Iowa Bell in his last year working for that company. That's because Don learned that blindness wasn't the problem. The problem is the low expectations that people have about being blind, and the low expectations that people have about people who happen to be blind. And it also has to do with the low expectations that we have of ourselves. Now, let me also be real clear. My definition of blindness isn't a total loss of eyesight. My definition of blindness is that if you lose enough eyesight that you have to use different techniques to do the same things that you did when you were fully sighted, then you are blind. That means people who are so-called partially sighted or low vision, but because they've lost enough eyesight that they can't do things the same way, those people are blind. By that, I'm saying you should learn the same techniques. Now, a lot of you may not choose to learn to read Braille, but you might learn enough about Braille so that you could label things, for example, so you could read them in the dark or read them when the lighting is low because you're not going to be able to do it well with your eyesight. Learning to use other techniques, learning to use a cane, even though, well, I have enough eyesight, I don't really need to do that. That works until you really need the cane. And let me tell you a story about Joe in New Jersey. Joe was going blind. He still had a good amount of eyesight, and the New Jersey Commission for the Blind gave him a cane and said, you ought to use this, but you got to use your eyesight as much as you can. Got to save that and practice that eyesight. And Joe did not use the cane well. Joe went every day across the river from New Jersey into Pennsylvania, from Mount Laurel to Philadelphia, where his job was. He took the train every day. Joe was walking along the train one day to get on and go into Philadelphia, saw the place where the door would be, and he turned to go into the door and promptly fell between the cars. Because he wasn't at the door, he wasn't using his cane, and the lighting wasn't good enough for him to see that he was, in fact, not at the door, but at the space between the cars. If he had been using his cane, that never would have happened. Now, the train was about to start to move, and they got the train stopped, and they got Joe out, and everything was fine. But I will tell you, from that day on, even though Joe had a fair amount of eyesight, he used a cane because he knew that it could enhance what he did. He did not continue to be ashamed of using a cane and looking like a blind person using a cane. He realized that that cane made the difference between life and death. So I'm telling all of you this to say, you may have some eyesight, but learn the blindness skills, because if you lose the rest of your eyesight and you haven't learned them, you're going to start all over. And why should you have to do that when you can learn them now and have the best of eyesight and the best of those skills to give you more opportunity than you otherwise might have had? You won't get that chance again. Don't miss it. So again, all of that sort of thing happens because of people's view of blindness, people's attitudes, including the attitudes of many who happen to be blind or losing our eyesight because we don't know better. It doesn't matter if you're blind from birth or not. It simply doesn't. That's not what's going to make it possible for you to survive. What makes it possible for you to survive and function and grow and do stuff is your attitude and what you decide you're willing to do to learn skills that will help you do it, because the reality is those skills work. My parents were told when it was discovered that I was blind, I was born with eyesight, but after 2 days being given a pre-oxygen environment, I lost my eyesight. The retina didn't grow properly. It's a condition at the time that was known as retrolenteral fibroplasia, and I don't know how to spell that. Buy a copy of Thunderdog because it's in there. We have them on sale. We're selling them. I'll autograph every book, and you too can learn how to spell retrolenteral fibroplasia. We have audio and print books. So, in any case, when my parents learned that I was blind, they were also told by the doctors to send me to a home because no blind child could ever grow up to amount to anything at all. That blind children really will never be productive members of society, and you shouldn't be burdened with him. My parents, father with an 8th grade education, mother with a high school diploma, told the most learned scientists in Chicago, Illinois, where I was born, you're wrong. He certainly can, and we're going to give him that opportunity. Take him home, and he's going to learn to do stuff just like any other kid would. And so I went home, and I learned to be a kid like anyone else would. And I learned that I could do a lot of stuff. I went to kindergarten when I was four in Chicago, you did that sort of thing. And I actually started to learn to read Braille. I moved to California because my father got a job when I was five out in California, and we moved out here, and I didn't get to use Braille because I had to, first of all, take a second year of kindergarten. I was at the Palmdale School District Tuesday night speaking to a retreat of administrators, and I asked them if any of them had ever had a second year kindergarten. And I said, I thought I was pretty unusual. I got 2 years, you know. But the second year was pretty boring because they didn't have anyone to teach a blind kid how to function. I didn't learn Braille skills again until I was in the fourth grade. I didn't learn to use a white cane at all, but I did learn to travel. I learned to listen. I learned to ride my bike around our rural neighborhood. I walked to school every day. I didn't need guidance to get there. I learned where all the rooms were. I learned how to travel. Now, I don't advocate that. I think a cane is extremely important for people to learn to use. But the cane isn't the big deal. I can teach anyone in the room to use a cane in 5 minutes. I've said that to the staff earlier. No offense to O&M people. I can teach anyone to use a cane in 5 minutes. Teaching you to have the confidence and the commitment and the determination to use that cane and explore your world takes months. It's a dog because they're prejudiced against canes too. You say, fetch the stick, and they go looking for the cane, you know. My dog does that, no. But it's not the cane part that's the challenge. It is all the other parts of adjusting, learning, becoming confident, and learning to hear and be aware of your surroundings. Those are the issues that one has to deal with, and that takes months for anyone to learn to do. That's the part I learned before I even learned to use a cane. So when I finally picked up a cane, it took me 5 minutes to learn the technique, and I was off and running because I already was a good traveler. I actually got a cane before I got a cane, and it was for the same reason. The school determined that I was a good traveler, so I actually got a guide dog when I went into high school. But I went on to through school. I went to college, and I got a master's degree in physics from the University of California at Irvine. Now, along the way, I faced discrimination. In fact, when I was in high school, the superintendent sent a note to the principal of our school, who referred it to the vice principal, who knew me, that said that I would not be allowed to ride on the school bus with my guide dog because there was a rule in the school district's rule book that said no live animal could ride on the school bus. And when I heard about that, and the vice principal, Mr. Fisher, called me in about it, and he wasn't happy about it either. I said, but Mr. Fisher, there's this law, we learned at a guide dog school, section 643.5 of the Penal Code of the State of California back in 1964, that said that no blind person with a guide dog could be denied the right to take their dog anywhere that the public could go, including on any common carriers. As we learned, the school bus is considered a legal common carrier. We won't go into the legal definitions of all that. You could go look it up in the library in Black's Law Dictionary as well as I can. Or now you can find it online if you learn those skills, so you don't get to work. In any case, my father, with his eighth grade education, demanded a hearing before the school board. The Saturday before the meeting, he went to the library and learned exactly what I just told you, that Black's Law Dictionary and case law defined a school bus as a common carrier, and that we certainly could take my dog on the school bus, and it was against the law to deny me access. So we went to the school board meeting. They did some of their little business things like the school boards and all that stuff, you know. And eventually it got to be our turn. The superintendent got up and stated his case and said what the situation was and said, this is our rule, and that's all there is to it. The chair of the board was Mr. Cartosian, who was a lawyer who had presided at my Boy Scout Star Court of Honor, I want to point out. And he said to my father, well, Mr. Hingson, do you have anything you want to say? And my dad got up, and he said, well, yes, I do. And he recited chapter and verse of the law and this and that and the other stuff and all that. And then he said, so ultimately, the only decision this board has to ponder is which one of you wants to spend a year in the penitentiary and pay a $1,000 fine. The superintendent stood up in a very arrogant voice, and I recall it well, said, is he right? And there was this pause. And then Mr. Cartosian said, yep. Then the board voted 3-2 to support the superintendent. 3-2 to keep me off the school bus. Now, they were paying someone to drive me to school, and under the law, what does it make that car?
A common carrier.
Hello. But we were now talking separate but equal, and it wasn't even separate but equal. My father wrote to the governor of the state of California. And among other things, he reminded the governor that we had met the previous year at a Boy Scout function at the Antelope Valley Fairgrounds, but he cited the case chapter and verse. We don't know what happened. We learned later that on a Wednesday, the superintendent was summoned to Sacramento. Would have loved to have been a fly on the wall. But all I know is that same Friday, the papers went out and I was reinstated. Monday, I was told I could ride the bus again.
Perseverance.
Perseverance is right, but it taught me two things. One, that you could fight City Hall and win if you had a just and right case, but it also taught me that people were going to treat me different because I was blind, and they didn't know better, or it was worse than that. But it still was blatant, plain discrimination.
Right.
And that is...
That's true with a secondary disability, too.
That's true with any disability. It's not just blindness, but we're dealing with blindness here. But it is. It's true of any disability. I'll tell you stories. My wife, by the way, uses a wheelchair. She's been in a chair her whole life. It's a great marriage, however. She reads, I push, works out well. But we went into a restaurant one day for breakfast. It was a Saturday, and we get up to the counter, and we're standing there, and she's sitting in the chair. You know, and of course, so she's lower than other people, so they have to look kind of down to see her. And I'm not making eye contact necessarily at all. Finally, my wife said, well, the server's in front of us and she's not saying anything. She doesn't know how to deal with us or who to talk to. So I just said, so Karen, you think they'll seat us for breakfast? And then the poor server got, our hostess got out of her what do you want to call it, fugue or whatever. Anyway, she seated us and everything was fine. But people don't know how to deal with people who are different than they are. You guys don't know how to deal with people who are different than you. And a lot of people in this room and outside, I dare say, really don't get the fact that you're not different simply because you're blind. You may do things in a different way. But if you want to really deal with something that's different, then go find a Martian. You know, that's the different stuff. But the reality is we're all people. And blindness should not and is not the problem. We live, however, in a world that subscribes to a vision-centric model just because it believes that eyesight is the only game in town. And that works until there's a power failure or until it's nighttime and you don't turn the lights on and you're trying to go to the bathroom, right? Thomas Edison invented the electric light bulb for one reason and one reason only. If you want to use the Americans with Disabilities Act definition, he invented the electric light bulb to provide a reasonable accommodations for light-dependent people who get around in the dark. And why is that any different than somebody developing Braille or insisting that we use Braille, insisting that we all learn Braille, no matter what our age? You know, most people learn to read print when they're very young because they're born sighted. But the ones who are born blind are not always an opportunity to learn to read Braille because people nowadays say, well, there's all this technology. You can listen to books and you can do this. Try to do graduate physics and discuss Lagrangian dynamics, confluent hypergeometric equations, spherical Hankel functions, spherical Bessel functions, the Schrodinger equations, other quantum kinds of concepts and so on with a recording. Try to learn to spell from recorded literature. It doesn't work. Braille is the only game in town. Try to look at cans of food where you can't read the labels, right? You know, alternatives to that, including using some Braille dots or whatever, and there are other kinds of alternatives. But the bottom line is there are alternatives. They're not substitutes. They are alternatives. Good blind Braille readers read Braille at hundreds of words a minute because they've learned to do it. It's no more amazing than sighted people learning to read at hundreds of words a minute. That's okay, because most sighted people don't do that.
kids today watch too much TV. But on the other hand, let's go back to that. So people say, you know, you don't need Braille. You've got all this stuff on recorded materials and all stuff. Then why do they teach sighted kids to read print when they can watch cartoons and all that other stuff and deal with pictures?
Right.
But that's not what happens. They insist that sighted children learn print, and people should insist, educators should insist, that blind children learn Braille, because it's the only means of reading and writing that we have available to us. Those are skills that I learned, fortunately. And as a result, I put them to use and was able to and continue to be able to function on a job and do all the other things that I might want to do. I have the luxury of deciding when I want to use Braille, when I want to use a computer that talks fast, or use other alternatives that may help me perform the jobs that I want. They're no different than using your eyes. Except I think I have a wider option of choices, because most sighted people are stuck with their eyes. I love it when I fly on airplanes and the flight attendant says at the beginning, during their flight briefing, now if there's an emergency, you will just follow the lights to the exit and you'll go out the exit. That works really well on a smoke-filled aircraft, ma'am. Tell me, what row numbers are the emergency exits?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to go find out. You don't know? No, every aircraft has a different configuration. No, they don't. No, they don't. Not every aircraft. Not every model. If I go on 5 737s on a line, they all have the same configuration. If I go from a 737 to a 707 or a 747, different story. But configurations within a model of aircraft are traditionally the same. And even if they're different, it doesn't matter. The flight attendants should know what their aircraft is. And they should verbalize those seat numbers to every person on the aircraft. And they should do it as an automatic part of their briefings, because if the aircraft is full of smoke, I guarantee you, you won't see the emergency lighting system. You can't. And there have been too many examples of that, where there have been emergencies and people couldn't. But we won't go into those stories. I could tell you stories. But the bottom line is, that's something that blind people could teach the rest of the world. But the rest of the world won't adopt the alternative technique, and I have to force someone to get me the information. I've had flight attendants refuse to get me that information, so I just finally say, so you're telling me you refuse to allow me to fly safely as a passenger who happens to be an Executive Platinum American Airlines passenger, and you're telling me you won't give me the information so I'm less safe than anyone else? Is that what you're telling me? Because I'm glad to report that to American. I get the data. I don't have any problem doing that, because what it really means is they don't value me as much as anyone else, even though I happen to be a very frequent flyer on the airline. And it doesn't change very quickly, because that's not what we as a society think about blindness and blind people. So we do have challenges, and I don't mean to say I'm arrogant or whatever, but I believe I have a right to the same opportunity to survive as anyone else, and I will do what I need to make sure that I have the best chance of surviving in an emergency as anyone else has. And I can probably benefit other people. And I've been in emergencies. I know what it's like. The biggest one, September 11th, 2001.
Yeah.
I've given an idea of some of the things that I've learned. So I went through college, graduated, had a number of jobs, and eventually ended up in New York City. I lived in New Jersey and took the train in every day, and we worked on the 78th floor of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center. That's over 3 football fields in the air. It's over 1,000 feet in the air. And it was great, because we had elevators that went straight to my floor, and I loved to try to convince people when they were coming to our office that we had arranged a special elevator just for them. And some of them really bought into that. It was great. There were really large elevators. They were like 30 or 40 people. I always wish I had one of those just for my office. It would have been fun. In any case, on September 11th, we were going to be conducting some sales seminars that day, teaching some of our partners how to sell our products. That day, the night before, I had gone to my home and backed up my computer data because I worked for a company that specialized in selling products that backed up networks. So if you were a Wall Street firm, for example, you were required by the SEC to keep all of your data backed up and keep it off-site for 7 years. And the people in New York would record their data on our products, and then they'd take the tape site, and as was advertised, they stored them under mountains and so on in New Jersey. You ever seen a mountain in New Jersey? They are clueless. They have no idea what a mountain is in New Jersey. We lived next to a town called Mountainside. It was up like 300 feet above the rest of the area. It's kind of funny. You know, we talked about real mountains. But anyway, they stored their data. So I always went home every night and backed up my data. On September 11th, I went into the office and got there about 7:40 in the morning. I was the Mid-Atlantic Region Sales Manager. I had opened the office for the company. I was hired to do that. I hired to establish a sales presence. Even though we sold mostly through other companies, Wall Street firms wanted manufacturers to have their own offices. They wanted the right people to beat up, right? They didn't want to beat up on all the resellers when a product didn't work right. They wanted to go right to the source. So they wanted people in the city, and it made sense for us to have a presence there. When I was looking for a date, I discovered something very quickly in 2000. The best place, the cheapest place in New York City to get real estate to open an office, bar none, was the World Trade Center, because they had that bombing in 1993, and they still couldn't get the place full. So we got office space at $2 a square foot, $2,800 for 1,400 square feet of office space. It was cool, and it was prime location, looking south over the Statue of Liberty and the southern end of Manhattan and all sorts of neat things. It was great, and all the front of the office was all glass and so on. On the 4th of July, people would come to our office to look down on the fireworks displays. My employees wanted to bring a keg of beer, and I said, no, you know, if you get drunk and you fall through, who's going to get blamed? I'm not going to take that responsibility. So I arrived at about 7:40 in the morning. As I arrived, there was a gentleman there with a cart. He was bringing breakfast from the Port Authority cafeteria. We had ordered breakfast to be delivered so that we could have breakfast for all the early arrivals and so on. We got there. I showed him where I wanted him to set up breakfast, and he did that while I went in and got the laptop projector to be able to do our slideshows and so on. And yeah, blind people can do PowerPoint presentations as well as anyone else. That we have processes to do that. I had a completely detailed Braille script that not only had all the on the slides, but special descriptions that I created telling me exactly where everything appeared. So when they're looking at images, I could point over my shoulder and say, on the left side of the screen, you can see, because they're facing it, obviously, on the left side, you could see the ATLP 3000 that will hold 16 tape drives, 326 tape cartridges, and we have what's called Prism technology. You can see a depiction of it there, which allows me to actually connect 5 libraries together, giving me 80 tape drives and 1,630 tape cartridges all in one big, huge, massive library. And on the right side of the screen, you can see the ATLP 1000, which is a little baby unit that only holds 30 tape cartridges and one tape drive, and all sorts of things, and go on and on and on. Drove people to distraction. We went and did a demo at Solomon Brothers once, or a presentation. And after the presentation, people came up and they say, we're really angry at you. We're not happy with you. Mostly when people come in here, they're pointing at the screen and they're turning around and looking at it, and we can fall asleep because it bores us and all that. But you never look away from us. We forget you're blind, and you just point over where you want us to look. We're really ticked at you because we didn't dare fall asleep because we thought you'd see us. And so my response to that was, of course, well, it doesn't matter. Even if you realized I was blind and you fell asleep, the dog's down there taking notes. That was my fifth guide dog, Roselle. In any case, so we were getting ready to do the slideshows and all that. I got all the equipment. I took it into the conference room where we were going to do the presentations. The guy had finished setting up breakfast, and he left. And about that time, David Frank, a colleague from our corporate office in California, arrived, along with some early guests from our distributor, Ingram Micro, who was bringing in the reseller people who'd be learning our products. And we all got to work, set things up. The Ingram Micro folks had breakfast and all that. And David and I did our last responsibility before the seminars were to start. We reached my office and created a list of all the people who would be attending that day, because we had to send it on letterhead to the Port Authority people who run the World Trade Center, That way, when someone came in and said, I'm Elmo Schwartz, and I'm here for the demonstrations of the quantum system up on the 78th floor, they'd look on the list, and if they see Elmo Schwartz's name, they would just have him stand in front of my camera, they'd take his picture, they'd put it on a badge that's on a chain that he had to wear around his neck whenever he was in the building, and it was only good for the one day, because they were very security-minded. Anyway, then Elmo could come up, and so we wanted to give people a list, because the alternative was they called us every time somebody was there to come up and see us, and we didn't want to get 50 phone calls that day. So I was just reaching for stationery to print the list when suddenly we heard a muffled explosion, we felt the building shudder, and then the building began to tip. Now imagine a spring sitting on a table, and you hold the bottom of it down or you fasten it to the table and you push on the top of the spring, you're bending the spring over, it's flexing. That's what happened to the World Trade Center Tower 1 that day. Tall buildings like that are actually just big springs. They're made to flex in windstorms and so on, and that's what happened. The airplane, as we learned later, hit the building. So what we did was to sort of flex over. Immediately, having grown up in Palmdale, California, on the San Andreas Fault, I knew building moves, go stand in a doorway, and that's what I did. My dog, Roselle, was asleep under my desk, and David was in the room with me. He was just holding on to my desk and didn't come to the door, just stood there. I guess David kind of figured, well, if we're going to fall, we're going to fall. You know, and as far as from my perspective, it was just habit, but, you know, if we were going to fall, we were going to fall, because standing in the doorway of a non-bearing wall really was going to protect you a lot, right? In any case, we were trying to figure out what was going on. Our guests were in our conference room meeting next door until all this started. David said, well, you think it was an earthquake? You know, I'm sitting there going, David, you know, you're living in Irvine, California now, but David was from the Bronx. What does he know? So I said, no, the building wasn't moving side to side or anything. It was going in one direction. I said, you think it was an explosion? Because we heard a little explosion. He said, well, it wasn't very loud, so I still don't know what's going on. I agreed with him. We stood there. The building kept tipping and tipping. We moved about 20 feet. And finally, the building kept moving, and David and I said goodbye to each other because we thought we were about to take a 78-floor plunge to the street. Then the building slowed down. Eventually, it stopped, and it started coming back the other way. And I remember letting out my breath. I didn't realize I was holding my breath, but I let it out. And the building kept moving and moving and moving, and finally it got back to a vertical position, and it stopped. And as soon as it did, I went into the office. And I met Roselle coming out from under my desk, so I took her leash and I told her to heel, which meant to come around on my left side and stop and sit. About the time she sat, the building straight down about 6 feet. Now, today we know that's because the expansion joints, or the joints of the spring, were going back to their normal configuration. So we started moving after the building dropped. David turned around and looked out the window and started shouting, oh my God, Mike, there's fire and smoke above us. We got to get out of here. The building's on fire. We can't stay here. And I said, slow down, David. We'll get out. No, we got to get out of here right now. The building's on fire. Our guests began to scream. They must have seen it. They were moving toward our exit. I kept saying, David, slow down. No, we got to get out of here. The building's on fire. I could hear things falling outside the window, and when he said, there are millions of pieces of burning paper falling outside the window, I realized that's what I was hearing. But David kept saying, we got to get out, and I kept saying, slow down. You got the picture, the sighted guy seeing all the stuff, and the blind guy saying, slow down. Finally, David said, you don't understand. You can't see it. The big line. Problem was, it was what David wasn't seeing. Roselle is afraid of thunder. Roselle was sitting by my side, wagging her tail, yawning, being bored, who woke me up, and not in any way, shape, or form reacting. I knew Roselle well enough, having worked with her since November of 1999, 22 months, I knew that if there was something that were concerning her or causing her to be afraid, she would not be sitting there quiet and calm. So whatever was happening wasn't so imminently affecting us that we couldn't evacuate in an orderly way. That is teamwork. And that's what Roselle and I have, is a team approach to working. We each have a job to do. The job of a guide dog is to be the pilot, to make sure we walk around things and so on. It is still my job to know where to go and how to get there, to give the dog directions. We work together. So I was observing this, and finally I got David to focus and said, look, get our guests to the stairs. Then when they're gone, we'll check the office one more time and leave. So he went to make sure that they were at getting to the stairs. He got them to the stairs. I called my wife, Karen, to know that there had been an explosion or something, and I didn't know any more details. I'd let her know more when I could. Then, as David came back, I hung up from her, and then David and I swept the office. No one else was there. We went to the stairs, and by 8:50 in the morning, we had started down. Immediately, I began smelling an odor, and I couldn't place it for a few floors, and finally, I realized I was smelling the fumes from burning jet fuel. I heard that.
Not a good smell.
Yeah. We're putting a dog to sleep for you, you guys outside. In any case, I finally realized I was smelling the fumes from burning jet fuel. And I observed that to others around me, and they said, yeah, we couldn't figure it out. That's right. Because a lot of us were frequent travelers, but I identified that smell. And then we all realized, well, maybe we were hit by an airplane, but we certainly didn't know the details. And so we just walked down the stairs. We got down about 10 floors, and then a woman passed us, surrounded by a group of people. They had yelled from above, burn victim, come move to the side. And David described this woman. She was very badly burned over the upper part of her body. Her clothing had been burned away, but she was ambulatory and she was walking down the stairs, probably in shock. And a few floors later, again, burn victim coming through, move to the side. And another person, even worse than the first, passed us. I think we started to realize how bad it must be above us, although we still didn't know any details of what was going on. Soon after that, a woman near us on the stairs just stopped and said, I can't go on. I can't breathe. We're not going to make it out of here. And nine of us stopped, surrounded her, and had a group hug right there on the stairs. And I said, come on, you can go on. Other people said, you can do it. Roselle gave this lady kisses, and finally she was able to keep going. We had to work together to get out. We had to help each other because it was the only way we were going to get out without panic. And we sort of instinctively knew that if we didn't keep panic down, we would have been trampled and nobody would have made it out even uninjured. When we got to about the 50th floor, suddenly my friend David said, Mike, we're going to die. We're not going to make it out of here. And I had noticed that he was getting pretty quiet. When he said that, I just snapped back at him, David, stop it. If Roselle and I can go down these stairs, so can you. And he told me later that snapping at him like that actually brought him a spunk and that he was able to continue to go down the stairs. But one of the things he then did was to say, you know, I got to have my mind on something. I'm going to walk a floor below you, and I'm going to shout up to you everything that I see on the stairs. Did I need that? No. Did it help him and make him feel good? Yeah. Was it nice to hear his voice down there and hear him that it was clear? Yeah, not necessary, but great. But it's even better than that, and it's even more important than that. Because what I realized later was that what David did was one of the remarkable things that ever happened that day that I recall. And that is that he went down and he started shouting like, I'm on the 48th floor, everything is okay now, we're going on down. 47th floor, all clear. What David was doing, whether he realized it or not, was being a beacon and a focal point for people above him and below him who were within the sound of his voice, who were hearing him say, somewhere on the stairs, we're okay. He gave hundreds, maybe thousands of people something to focus on. And that was important. So we kept going down the stairs. And other things happened along the way, but suffice it to say that the next major event, I think, was we got to David, the 30th floor. I was on the 31st floor, and David suddenly shouted up, hey, I see firefighters coming up the stairs. Move to the side. Let them by. Well, the stairs were wide enough that we could do that. We could move to the side and turn in toward the center, and people could pass us. So we're standing there, and the first guy gets to me, and he stops right in front of me. I actually came down to where David was, and he was telling me that these people were coming, and they had these big, heavy packs on their backs, maybe weighed 100 pounds. They were like 50 or 60, but who knew? And they were carrying oxygen cylinders, fire axes, all the things to fight the fire, and they were dressed in heavy protective clothing. The first guy gets to me, and in this heavy New York accent, he goes, "Hey, buddy, you okay?" I went, "Yeah, we're really good." "Well, that's really nice. We're going to send somebody down the stairs, which you to make sure you get up. Not with you, but which up." That's how they talk back there in New York. Witcha, W-T-Y-A. I think it's a word. Any case, I said, "Look, we're really okay. I don't need any help." "Well, that's really nice, but we're going to send somebody downstairs with you to make sure you get out." You know, did he want to be helpful? He did. But he was also assuming I really couldn't do it on my own, and they needed to protect me. And I again said, "Look, I really don't need help. And there's a reason I did it, which I'll get to in a moment." I said, "Look, I just came down from the 78th floor. We're really okay." And he said, "That's really nice, but we're going to have somebody go with you to make sure you get out." And I said, "Look, I've got my guide dog here, Roselle. She and I are working together. We're good." And he said, "Oh, that's really nice. What a nice dog." And he starts petting Roselle. Wasn't the time to give him a lecture about don't pet a guide dog in harness. Also wasn't the time to say, "Look, blindness isn't the problem. It's your perception that's the problem." The only thing I could do was my lab card. I turned to David and I said, "Look, I got my buddy David here. David and I are working together. He can see, and we're working together. We'll get out." And he turns to David. "You're with him?" David goes, "Yeah, he's good." So the guy says, "Okay, we'll go on up." So you see, it took the sighted guide card to make that happen. But he petted Roselle a few more times, and then he started going up the stairs, probably just having received, because Roselle gave him kisses too, probably just having received the last unconditional love he ever got in his life. Because we don't know if he came down or how he came down. Look, why did I resist? Did I need to? Yeah, actually, because I don't know how many of you have this experience, but when people want to help you, they'll come and they'll grab your arm, and if you start out there, they lift you up, and they do all sorts of things that were really dangerous. But more important than all of that, I knew, because I spent a lot of time learning about what to do in a case of an emergency in the World Trade Center, and I knew they had to carry their equipment up. I knew that they were a team. And I did not want to be the cause of that team splitting up from doing its job, especially needlessly. I didn't want to hear on the news, not knowing how bad it was going to get, I didn't want to hear on the news that somebody got injured because one of their teammates was helping a blind man go down the stairs. It wasn't necessary, and I didn't want to be responsible for that. I did not want to break up their team. It was crucial not to. Somebody would have had to carry his equipment up. Or they would have had to take the time to split up the pack. It wasn't going to happen. So we finally worked it out, and he went on up, and we went on down. About the 26th floor, people started passing out water because it was getting pretty warm with all the bodies on the stairs. It wasn't fire. It was just all the bodies on the stairs walking down and going up. So Roselle and I and David shared a bottle of water. We made our hands into cups and gave Roselle some water, and then we went on down. David reassumed his scout in a floor below us, and finally he got to the first floor, and he said, "Hey, I'm at the first floor." We were at the second. And the water sprinklers are on, creating a curtain of water across the doorway, and that was to keep fire out or in if it broke out. Suddenly he was gone. I got to the first floor, heard this torrential downpour of water, told Roselle, "Forward, hop up." And we burst through this incredible torrential downpour of water, suddenly coming out the other side into the lobby of One World Trade Center, which was a typical office lobby, but not that day. The water was ankle deep on the floor. With every step I took, I stepped on ceiling tiles that had fallen from the ceiling and felt them crush under feet. People, "Don't go that way. Go this way. Don't go outside. Go this way. Go to the center of the complex. Get out of here. Go this way. Don't go that way. No, don't go that way." This guy comes up to me and David, he says, "I'm with the FBI, we'll get you to the right place." And I'm sitting there going, "The FBI, I didn't do it. I didn't." "No, I didn't. I just said, well, FBI, what's going on?" And he said, "Well, there's no time to tell you." We still didn't know. Do you get the impression, though, that I like information? I would rather have known, and he wouldn't have been able to tell me anything that would have caused me to panic. Knowing at least gives me the opportunity to make choices. I may be very worried, and I may not really like a situation, but I would rather know. But I didn't get that opportunity. So we followed him. We went outside into the central office part of the part of the World Trade Center on the first floor, out of the office buildings, which is an indoor shopping mall. There was a Ben & Jerry's ice cream kiosk right outside of the doors of One World Trade in the beginning of the mall on our side. Didn't stop for ice cream. There were other office buildings. There were banks and other things. And eventually we went up an escalator, and outside of the complex, as far away from the Twin Towers as we could be. When we got outside, we were just told to leave the area. But we stopped, and David looked around, and he said, "Mike, Tower 2's on fire." I said, "What? Tower 2's on fire." Had no clue. Didn't know what was going on. So we walked over to Broadway, and we started going north on Broadway. We're on the west side of the street, so right to my left was a building, to my right was Broadway. We crossed several streets, got to Fulton Street. Then we crossed that and went to the next street, which was Ann Street going to the right and Maiden Lane to the left, which is the street that goes down to the New York Stock Exchange. We stopped there because David wanted to take some pictures of Tower 2 burning, which was like about 100 yards diagonally away from us. So he took pictures. I tried to call my wife, Karen. I couldn't get through. The circuits were busy because a lot of people were saying goodbye to loved ones and so on, and calling from the towers and so on where they were trapped. I had just put my phone away. David was putting his camera away when a police officer yelled, "Get out of here, it's coming down!" And suddenly we heard this rumble that within a half a second or so became this deafening roar. I describe it as kind of a sound of a freight train and a waterfall combined. You could hear glass tinkling and breaking and metal clattering, and then this white noise sound of the building pancaking down. But the building was collapsing. Whatever it was doing, everyone turned and ran. David turned and ran. He was gone. It was just Roselle and me. We turned 180 degrees and started running back the way we came. So now I'm running south on Broadway with a building on my right side. And as I ran, I remember thinking to myself, "God, I can't believe you got us out of a building just to have it fall on us." And I remember as soon as I thought that, I heard a voice in my head as clearly as you hear me now that said, "Worry about what you can't control. Focus on running with Roselle and the rest will take care of itself." And I instantly had this sense of security and peace that if we worked together, we'd be okay. And I knew we were going to be great. We ran to Fulton Street, turned right, ran a little bit, caught up to David, who had gone the same way and then realized that he had just left us and turned around to find us. But before he could start off back the way he had come, we caught up to him. And I think that whole experience was probably the worst panic for me, if it were that I experienced. David apologized. I said, "Look, don't worry about it. Let's keep going," because the building was collapsing. And we started to run, and we were engulfed in the dust cloud, all the dirt and debris and fine particles of Tower 2 breaking up and collapsing. David said that the dirt and dust was so thick that you couldn't see your hand 6 inches in front of your face. I can tell you it was so thick that with every breath I took, I felt stuff going down my throat, into my lungs, and settling in my lungs. So we ran, knowing that we had to get out of that dust cloud, so I just started telling Roselle, "Right, right." I don't know whether she could hear me over all the noise. I don't even know if she could see anything, but we kept running. And suddenly, I heard an opening on my right, and Roselle must have seen it because she turned right, she took one step, and she stopped and would not move. She just planted her feet and wouldn't go further. And I realized, she's not being afraid, she's not shaking, there must be a reason. Stuck out a foot to check and a hand along the wall, and discovered that we were at the top of a flight of stairs. Roselle had done her job perfectly. She did exactly what she was supposed to do. We walked downstairs and found ourselves, after a couple of flights, in the arcade opening to the Fulton Street subway station. When we got to the bottom of the stairs, there was a woman at the bottom of the stairs crying, saying, "Help somebody, I don't want to fall into the subway, my eyes are full of dirt, I can't see, somebody help." I came down very close to her, so I walked over to where she was, and I said, "Hey, don't worry about it, you're like from the stairs, you're not in any danger. My name's Mike, I happen to be blind, I've got my guide dog here, we'll make sure that you stay okay, don't worry about it." And she grabbed my arm, and I asked her name. She said her name was Carol. I said, "Just clean out your eyes. You're okay. Don't worry about it." We were there a couple minutes, and then a gentleman came up the stairs from further down. He said his name was Lou. He was in the subway system, and he said he'd take us all down. There were about 8 or 9 of us there. We went down to an employee locker room down in the subway system. We got there, there was a water fountain, there were some fans and benches to sit on. Everyone was hacking, trying to clear their lungs and so on. Not saying much. We were there for about 10 minutes, then a police officer found us, and you need to leave the area right now. The air is clear up above, so you got to get out of here right now. Well, we went to where he directed us, which was back the way we come. We went up the stairs, re-arcade, went up the last two flights of stairs, and we found ourselves, in fact, outside. The air was still pretty bad, but it was better than it had been. David looked around, and he said, "Mike, oh my God, there's no World Trade Center Tower 2 anymore. All I see are hundreds of feet tall of smoke and fire. It's gone." I said, "Are you sure?" "Yeah, it's gone." We stood there for a moment, and then we just turned and walked west on Fulton out of the area. We walked for about 10, 15 minutes, maybe a quarter mile or so. We weren't going fast, but fast enough. We were out of the area. Suddenly, we heard the train waterfall sound again, and we knew that it must be Tower 1 collapsing. David looked back, and he saw another dust cloud coming. We kind of ran to the side because it was pretty condensed. We were able to stay out of most of it, but we did hunker down and duck down so that we were a little bit more protected, and we stood there till the wind passed and the sound died away. Then we stood up again, and David looked around and said, "Oh, my God, Mike, there's no World Trade Center anymore." I said, "You sure? What do you see?" And he said, "All I see are fingers of fire and flame, hundreds of feet tall and pillars of smoke. It's gone." We stood there. Then I got out my phone, and I called my wife, Karen, at our house. And this time I got through, and she was the first one to tell us that two aircraft had deliberately been crashed into the towers, one into the Pentagon, and a fourth was still missing over Pennsylvania. That's the first time we really learned what happened. The rest of the day, we worked toward getting up to Midtown Manhattan, and eventually I was able to get trains back to New Jersey and got home about 7 o'clock that night. And then we started to try to make sense of all of it. If you really want to put September 11th in perspective, however, as soon as we got home, I took Roselle's harness off, and the first thing she did before going out or anything was to go find her favorite tugboat and started picking a tug of war with my retired guide dog, Lenny. Oh. And they just played and played and played. If that doesn't put it all in perspective, I don't know what does, because dogs don't do what if. It was over. And she was never specifically threatened, so it didn't bother her. And I took that lesson to heart because, you know, no matter what happened, no matter who you want to get angry at and so on, getting mad at Osama bin Laden, getting mad at anyone wasn't going to help. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't seek justice, because those people did something that was an absolute attack against man. But you don't get mad, you get even. And it took years, and we took our eye off the ball in some ways, but eventually Osama bin Laden found justice. And I don't think that he got to heaven and found 72 virgins waiting for him. The Islamic faith doesn't teach really different things than does Christianity or Judaism. They're all religions, basically, of peace. Now, on the other hand, the story I heard is that Osama bin Laden, when he got to heaven, he met Muhammad at whatever the gate is or whatever, and got into heaven. And all of a sudden, somebody hit him in the back of the head with a rock. And they came up to him, and it turned out to be Patrick Henry. He said, "You're trying to give death to our country. We want liberty." And then somebody else came along and kicked him, and it was George Washington, the father of our country, Thomas Jefferson, and a whole bunch of people started kicking him and beating him. And he went back and talked to Muhammad. He says, "What is this? I don't understand." And Muhammad said, "You got it all wrong. You thought it was 72 virgins. It was 72 Virginians." But in all seriousness, getting mad at anyone wouldn't help. Certainly, this is not what the Islamic Church teaches. And so we should not be prejudiced and angry at that church any more than people were and are angry at us for the Crusades, you know, where we invaded, which was Christianity invading. You know, it happens. We got to really get over and recognize that there's a lot more in common to all of us than there is not common to all of us. But I tell you all of this to say I would never have been able to do what I did without learning the blindness skills that kept me alive and that I need to learn and use to live and function in society, and that all of those skills are available to all of you. You've got to recognize that blindness isn't the problem. It's your perhaps view of what it means to be blind. It's the low expectations that people have about us, that sometimes we have about ourselves. We need to overcome that. I was at an IKEA store about 4 years ago, and this young man came up to me in the store, 13 years old, and without saying anything else, he said, "I'm sorry." I went, "What?" He said, "I'm sorry." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I'm sorry that you can't see." Well, I probably didn't answer in the best way possible, but I said, "Well, actually, I'm really pretty sorry that you can see, because you are locked into one view." And, you know, blindness isn't the big problem. It's what people think about being blind. I've seen it so many times. My niece visited me from almost the time she was born, and actually from before she was born. Her mother and father visited me, and it was my wife's brother. But Alanya, is her name, came several times to visit our home in New Jersey, coming back from France. Gary was a professional ski guide and lived there half the year. She knew what it was like to be around a blind person, and that I did everything everyone else did. Well, one day, we visited them in their home in Idaho, where they lived half of the year. She was about 7 or 8 at the time. And I just said, after all the times that she had visited, I said, "I'm going to go take a look along the river with my guide dog." And she popped up and said, "You can't do that, you're blind." It didn't matter what she had seen. Society has such a strong hold on the view of blindness that it wasn't possible to break through that easily with her. But that's what we've got to change, and not everyone can do it. And not everyone is going to be willing to do it. But what we all in this room need to deal with is the fact that blindness isn't the problem. It's our perceptions, and that there are skills that allow us to do as much as we want. It's up to us to follow through and make it happen. And that's our story. So it's really been an honor to be here, and we do have Thunderdog books and all that. I'm going to be here for lunch. I don't know who cooked it, but that's okay.
I read the caterer.
There you are.
Larry the cater guy.
Larry the caterer. What about Sonnenberg the cook, huh?
Scary.
But or it wasn't Dan the chef or the cook. But I'm really honored to have had the opportunity to come and talk to you. I look forward to meeting more of you, and we do have the books, and if you have questions. Does anybody want to ask a question or two before we break?
Sure.
How much are they?
I think we're running.
All right, how much are the books? They're both $19.95, and that includes taxes, and we do take credit cards, checks, or cash. Mm-hmm. Not your firstborn child, like that Rumpelstiltskin guy.
I'm seeing you.
I have a question.
Yes?
Some people have said that the World Trade Center was brought down with explosives.
Some people say it was brought down with explosives.
You hear that?
Oh, I hear that all the time.
So what do you think about that?
Well, if it were brought down with explosives, why did it tip and then tip back? And, you know, there are a lot of conspiracy theorists out there.
The Russians.
But I was there, and I smelled the burning jet fuel, right? No, it was not a conspiracy. It was not brought down with explosives or anything like that. Something hit the building and caused it to tip. And I believe that it's exactly what it was. Somebody hijacked an aircraft or two aircraft and crashed them into the World Trade Center towers. And the only reason they collapsed is not because they were hit, but because they were fully loaded with jet fuel. And what happened was that the jet fuel destroyed enough of the infrastructure that caused them to collapse at some point. As one of the engineers who developed the World Trade Center and built it said, the issue isn't why they collapsed. The issue is why did they last so long? And they lasted so long because they did a great job. You guys, thanks much, and we'll be outside with the picnic.
Yeah, steal the microphone away.
Which? Let's see.
Well, thank you to everybody. So, Mike.